rocketmoney.com/rentalbookfigures, our expected mortgage payment will be $322.09. Step 4, determining the total income. What do you think that our 123 Main Street property is going to rent for? Now, it's kind of a silly question, isn't it? After all, you know nothing about the area. Remember, trying to determine the fair market rent depends on numerous factors, including location and the characteristics of the property. Now, a quick scan of Craigslist and the local newspaper for the area shows us that prices for a three-bedroom home in this neighborhood are renting for between $975 and $1,350 per month. The higher end of that spectrum seems to be nicer homes that have been rehabbed, where the lower end seems to be more in line with houses that need a ton of work. Since 123 Main Street will be rehabbed, we can expect to get near the top of that range, but we also don't want to price it too high in our estimates. So let's shoot for a $1,200 per month price for fair market rent. With this property, there are no obvious extra ways to make more money, no laundry machines, no storage buildings, etc. So we can move on. So our total monthly income at this point is $1,200 per month. Step number 5, determining our total expenses. Next, we need to nail down the expenses for 123 Main Street. To do this, let's take another look at that list of all possible expenses and determine which ones we might need to pay as a landlord. The mortgage? Yes, $322 per month. The taxes? Yes, $122.18 per month. Insurance? Yes, $56 per month. Flood insurance? No. Vacancy? Yes, 5% or $60 per month. Repairs? Yes, 5% or $60 per month. Capital expenditures. Let's estimate $150 for this property. Water? No. Sewer? No. Garbage? No. Gas? No. Electricity? No. HOA fees? No. Snow removal? No. Lawn care? Nope. Property management? Yes. 11% or $132. Other? No. Total? $902.27. According to our graph, we can estimate $902.27 per month in expenses for 123 Main Street. Of course, we would also want to check to make sure there were no other special expenses unique to this location or this house. But we've done that homework and we're comfortable with this number. Therefore, our total expenses per month is $902.27. Step 6, evaluate the deal. We now have all the numbers needed to make a decision on the property. Our total monthly income is $1,200. Our total monthly expenses are $902.27. To determine our cash flow, we subtract the expenses from the income. So $1,200 minus $902.27 equals $297.73. Therefore, we can estimate that per month, 123 Main Street will produce approximately $297.73 in cash flow on average over time. To get the annual cash flow, we simply multiply the number by 12 to get $3,572.76 per year. Now, we want to determine what kind of return on investment this cash flow represents. To do this, we simply need to divide the annual cash flow by the total invested capital, because annual cash flow divided by total invested capital equals your cash on cash return on investment. We determined back in step 2 that the total invested capital on this project would be $36,950. We've also estimated now that the annual cash flow would be $3,572.76. Therefore, $3,572.76 divided by $36,950 equals a 9.67% cash on cash return on investment. In this example, we could estimate that the property with this cash invested should return around 9.67% on our money. Remember, however, that this does not take into account the fact that the loan is being paid down every month, that the home has some incredible equity built in since we did a slight rehab on it, and that there may be other tax benefits to go with it, or that would at least minimize the tax we would need to pay on the property. Let's take this one step further and try to determine our overall return, the ROI that we'll see when we combine cash flow, equity growth, and loan paydown over time. A 9.67% return, a cash on cash return, might be a good number to know, but let's quickly compute the overall return for this property, assuming a few things. First, Let's assume that we'll hold property for 5 years and then we'll sell it. Let's also assume that appreciation will increase the value of the property 2% per year over those 5 years. In other words, up in step one, we determine the property was worth. In other words, up in step one, we determine that the property was worth $120,000. Therefore, at the end of year one, because of the 2% appreciation, it's now worth $122,400. At the end of year two, it's now worth $124,848. At the end of year three, $127,345. At the end of year four, $129,892. At the end of year five, $132,490. At the end of year five, our property, therefore, is worth $132,490. Of course, if we were to sell it, doing so would cost us some money. Again, we'll need to make a few assumptions. We know that real estate agents will typically charge around 6% or roughly $8,000. And there's other closing costs that will likely run around, we'll say $4,000. Plus, you know, we'll probably need to do some cleaning up of the property, like a new paint job. So let's add another $5,000 there. Therefore, our total sales expenses at this point would be $17,000 should we sell it 5 years from now. Next, we need to determine how much the mortgage balance would be at the end of 5 years. Our initial mortgage, if you recall, was $60,000. However, we know that in 5 years, that loan will have been paid down some. To determine just how much, we need to use an amortization calculator, which you can find easily online on a site like amortization-calc.com or just by searching Google for amortization calculator. By doing this, I can see that at the end of year five, we'll owe $55,004.72 on the loan. We now have all the puzzle pieces needed to determine our overall return. To do this, we will want to find out exactly how much profit we made over those 5 years. This profit is spread among two categories, cash flow and equity. Let's look at the equity first. The equity is the profit we'll get if we sell, not including any money we paid for a down payment or repairs. To determine this, we simply start with the sales price and deduct everything that has ever been paid for the property, including sales expenses, the loan payoff, and the total invested capital. For 123 Main Street, the figures are as follows. Our sale price, $132,490. Our sales expenses were $17,000. Our loan payoff was $55,004.72. And our total invested capital was $36,950. Therefore, our profit is $23,535.28. However, we are not quite done. We've also made some good cash flow over the previous 5 full years. A few moments ago, we estimated that this property would produce $3,572.76 in cash flow every year. Knowing that we held on to the property for 5 full years, we can simply multiply that by 5 to get our total received cash flow. So $3,572.76 times 5 equals $17,863.80. So we've made $17,863.80 in cash flow over those 5 years and another $23,535.28 in equity over the same time frame for a total of $41,399.08 in 5 years. But we're still not quite done. What does this actually mean? Well, remember, the total return is the return on investment we'll see when we combine the cash flow, the equity growth, and the loan paydown over time. It's similar to cash on cash return, but it includes all the profit made, not just the cash flow. Now, to determine our total return, we need to use the following formula. Total profit divided by total invested capital, and then divide that whole thing by time in years. If this is confusing to you, let me try to explain in words what we are doing. Essentially, we are doing the same return on investment calculation we've done in the past, just taking profit divided by investment. However, because we are spreading this out over a number of years, we need to divide by that figure to likewise spread the investment out over a number of years. So let's do this with 123 Main Street. We've made a total profit of $41,399.08. We'll divide that by our total invested capital of $36,950 to get a total return of 1.12, or 112.04%. Now we will divide that by 5 because we held it for 5 years. Therefore, our total return is 22.4%. We determined earlier that our total cash-on-cash return on investment on this property would be 9.67%. And now we can see that if our rehab caused the value to increase to $120,000, appreciation carried the value up 2% per year from there, and we sold for full value in 5 years, after expenses, we might expect a 22.4% overall each year for the next 5 years. However, we've made a number of assumptions that could or could not be true. What if appreciation carried the property's value up 5% per year? Or what if we received no appreciation? What if we held it for 10 years or 20 years? The point in this exercise is not to show you exactly what you will receive from a property, but to help you learn how to calculate these numbers. If you want to get even more fancy, you can pull out the IRR, the internal rate of return, or the MIRR, modified internal rate of return, but those discussions are far beyond the scope of this book. Once you have a firm grasp on why the numbers work the way they do, and you're able to do these calculations by hand, I'd encourage you to actually check out the Bigger Pockets Rental Property Calculator at www.biggerpockets.com/analysis to help you save a lot of time in doing these numbers. Everything we just went over can be done in just a couple minutes on the calculator, and numbers can easily be adjusted and changed as needed. For example, if you wanted to know what would happen with the rehab budget of $30,000 instead of $17,000, you can simply edit the report and run the numbers again, rather than starting over at the beginning and going through the whole process. Online calculators, like the Bigger Pockets Rental Property Calculator, can help you out tremendously and save you a lot of time once you understand the basics of how they work. Putting it all together. At this point, you can likely run the numbers on any potential deal just like a pro. If not, don't worry, you'll get better in time. I encourage you to just start analyzing deals every single day, both for practice, because practice makes perfect, and because real estate investing is a game of odds. The more deals you analyze, the more offers you can make, and the more deals you get accepted. Think about it. If you analyze 2 properties every day, at the end of the month, you'll have analyzed 60 different deals. Now, let's just assume that 10% of those deals, after analyzing, look promising enough to pursue and make an offer on. That leaves you with 6 properties that you can make an offer on every month. Of those 6, how many of those offers will get accepted? Perhaps 1? I think 1 out of 6 offers is pretty reasonable. Therefore, if you just analyzed 2 deals a day, made offers on 10% of them, and had just 1 out of 6 or 16% of those offers accepted, you could buy a new property every month. People often complain to me that they can't buy a deal, and I usually ask them, well, how many offers have you made this week? Or how many deals have you analyzed today? The answer, of course, is usually 0. So if you are looking to do more deals, start by analyzing more properties. It really is as simple as that. Of course, what if you start analyzing a lot of deals and no deals look promising? What if 100% of the properties for sale in your area are too expensive and don't look good after analysis? This is an increasing problem these days, one that is especially prevalent in expensive areas. If you find yourself in a city where home prices easily climb above $300,000, you might have a tremendous difficulty finding any deal that'll work. So how should you invest in real estate when you live in such an area? Well, let's find out. Chapter 6, Investing While Living in an Expensive Area. Chris Grosser once said, "Opportunities don't happen, you create them." "I'll be right over to take some photos," my agent said to the woman on the phone, who was calling to list her property for sale while I sat in my agent's office. He continued, "And I'm actually sitting here with one of my biggest clients. Do you mind if I bring him over and have him look at your property?" I followed my agent to the woman's house. I knew the location well because I owned another house on the same street already. I was actively looking for a house to flip, and this neighborhood could work well. After my agent signed a couple of documents with the woman, the property owner gave both of us a tour of the home. "I just need to get out of town," she complained. "My family has all recently moved to California, and this house is keeping me here. I just don't have the money to repair it." I made her an offer that day, which she readily accepted. $16,000. Yes, that's right, $16,000. The house wasn't in terrible shape, it wasn't in Detroit, but it did need a good deal of work to get it up to rentable standards. But for how many of you reading this book right now are thinking, just $16,000 for a house? That is insane. Yeah, it is. That was the lowest priced home I've ever purchased. To brag a little more, my 24-unit apartment only cost me $565,000. Also crazy, right? I mean, in some areas of the country, you can barely buy the lowest end home for what I paid for my apartment complex. So is that the secret to my success? Am I just lucky enough to live in an area where prices are cheap? It is a perfectly valid question. Sure, I'm located in a very low priced area, and I know that there are some areas where prices are astronomically high. Many major metropolitan areas like New York, Los Angeles, Denver, Seattle, and Washington DC have prices well above the national average. And don't get me started on San Francisco. If you live in such an area, this chapter is for you. I want to share a few thoughts I have concerning high price locations and how you can still invest while living in such a place. Are you looking for homes on sale? Let me ask you a question. How much do you pay for a gallon of milk? $3? $4? $5? These are all prices I see when I shop for milk, but I typically never spend more than $2.50. How is it possible that I can get milk for $2.50 a gallon while others are paying up to double that? It's because I'm actively looking for a deal. My $2.50 a gallon for milk is not normal. It's a sale. In the same way, the property prices I talk about are not normal. No one lists a home for $16,000 like the one I mentioned earlier, even in my area. Often, seasoned investors like me talk about the cheap prices we're getting to make a point, as I'm doing in this very section of the book. But remember, those prices are not retail prices. That home was actually listed at over $30,000 and still a low price, I know, but I knew the seller was motivated and I could solve her problem quickly. So are you actively seeking a deal? When you pull up a list of nearby homes for sale, are you simply looking at the average sale price and trying to compare that with the $16,000 deal I got? If so, you're going to be very disappointed. The average price for a home in my area is more than 10 times as expensive as what I offered. I've only seen a few properties that cheap, and most have major problems. The $16,000 deal was a special deal. The apartment complex for $500,000 was also special, because I only buy special deals. Now, they're not once-in-a-lifetime opportunities, but they're also not everyday deals. I forget now where I heard it, probably the BP forums, but to find a good deal, you should look at 100 homes, offer on 10, and only get one accepted. This means that just 1% of the deals that look promising actually are. So what does that mean for your business? Well, it means you need to look at a lot of properties. You can speed up the time by having a very defined standards that you follow, but in the end, you're simply going to need to look at a lot of properties and try to find a great deal. Next, let's talk about relativity. And no, we're not going to be talking about Einstein. Is the price relative? Let's go back to the analogy about milk. I have a bit of a riddle for you. When would it be the same for my budget to pay $5 for milk as it would be to pay $2.50? The answer, of course, is if I made twice as much money. In other words, if I suddenly made double my income but spent double the amount on milk, the percentage of my income I'm spending on milk would change. This is also true in real estate. A home that sells for $100,000 in one area might produce $1,000 per month in rent. However, that same style house in another area may sell for $300,000, but the rent may be $3,000 per month. It's all relative. So before you instantly assume you live in an area that is too expensive to invest in, decide first whether the math still works. Many times it will. Often, certain investments are working in your town, but they're just not working at your financial level. In other words, the numbers work, but they are so high that the barrier to entry is keeping you out. If so, there are creative methods you can use to get involved. For example, forming a partnership, raising private money, or engaging in real estate wholesaling can allow you to still be involved without having to pay that high price. There are also a lot of creative ways you can invest in properties that require far less money, which I talked about in my previous book, The Book on Investing in Real Estate with No and Low Money Down. I understand, of course, that in some areas, a home selling for $300,000 still may only rent for $1,000 a month. I understand that in some areas, the relativity between rent and price is completely out of whack. Sometimes properties are just not worth buying. What then? Well, what is working in your area? Perhaps your goal is to buy and hold single-family homes in Manhattan. I'm sorry, but that's probably not going to work out real well for you. Each location is optimal at certain things, but not at everything. If the math doesn't seem to work out on a certain type of investment in your area, perhaps it's time to consider what is working. Would wholesaling commercial properties be a better use of your time? What about multifamily properties? How about condo conversions? What about fast food triple net leases? Have you considered subsidized low-income housing? Before blacklisting your entire town, Make sure you take time to investigate exactly what your town is good at. Perhaps you'll discover a highly profitable investing strategy that your expensive town is excellent at. There are dozens of different ways to invest in rental properties. You might just need to find the right niche. To find what is working in your town, simply connect with investors who are actively engaged in your market. What are they investing in? How are they making a profit? Discover the secret to their success, and you'll find a path to your own. Have you checked the outskirts? How much do Starbucks employees make in downtown New York City? My guess is not a whole lot more than they make at my small, rural town. My point is this. The large percentage of society who make less than $15 an hour and work in expensive cities still need a place to live somewhere near work. Baristas are not making six figures, yet they still manage to work in expensive areas. How? Well, in nearly every expensive city, there are pockets of low-priced properties. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not advocating slumlording or investing in a dangerous ghetto. Those areas have problems and extra expenses of their own. Location is still key in any real estate investment. What I'm referring to is the middle-class neighborhoods on the outskirts and in the suburbs. Generally, these areas are found 20 to 40 miles outside the city center in smaller towns and communities. Speak with a good real estate agent about these areas or get on BiggerPockets and connect with some local successful investors to see where they are investing. Find the best location with the lowest prices and focus your efforts there. If still you find that there are no decent locations nearby that you can invest in, perhaps it's time to look outside your area and consider long-distance investing. Long-distance rental property investing. We've talked about ways of making real estate investing work in your area, but what about simply investing somewhere else in an area that does make sense? Is that a terrible idea? Well, not necessarily. However, investing at a long distance can prove difficult if not done correctly. When you are first learning the ropes behind real estate investing, you will quickly learn that there are a lot of ropes. Sometimes those ropes get tangled and need to be untangled, and investing from a long distance can make the untangling process difficult. That said, if investing outside your area makes the most sense to you, there are strategies that will work. In this next section, I'll outline three different strategies people use to invest in real estate from a long distance. Number one, DIY. The first method I call the DIY method because you will do it yourself. This is a method I probably wouldn't recommend to the average person just getting started because trying to do anything by yourself is tough. However, many people do invest at a distance on their own and they're able to do it quite well. The first step in DIY long distance investing is to establish your ideal location and truly understand that city. It helps to look somewhere where you have some sort of connection. For example, I grew up in Minnesota until my college sweetheart took me out west. So today, I would not be opposed to investing back in my homeland. I understand all the different towns, the main drivers of industry, and the areas to avoid, and I have connections to people there. Secondly, when investing at a distance with the DIY method, I highly recommend using an excellent property manager. I'll cover the topic of using property managers much more in depth in Chapter 17, but don't assume that it'll be easy to manage a property from thousands of miles away without a property manager. Yes, you could look up the phone number of a plumber or a handyman to take care of repairs, but who will check to make sure the work was done right? Who will make sure the tenant is abiding by their lease? Who will show a vacant unit to prospective tenants? And who will make sure the home is physically being taken care of? I'm not saying it's impossible to invest in real estate at a distance without a property manager, but it would not be my first choice. Perhaps the most difficult aspect of DIY long-distance investing is being able to buy the right property. After all, if you don't live near the location, it can be exceptionally hard to know the true value of a home by the little pictures and descriptions you see on the internet. Getting a true feel for the location without being there is tough. Therefore, if you plan to go this route, I recommend you spend a lot of time researching the location, as I'll explore in Chapter 8, and then actually take a trip there to see it firsthand. Drive the streets, talk to local business owners, speak with local real estate agents. Seek to truly understand as much as you can about the area and determine the best place to invest in that community. A $300 plane ticket is far less expensive than buying a bad deal. No matter how much research you do, you'll still never understand the area to the same depth that a local resident might. For that reason, you may want to consider foregoing the DIY method and instead use a long-distance partner. Number two, using a long-distance partner. A second technique some people use when investing at a distance is partnering with someone who currently lives in a good location and using that person to be the boots on the ground. The right partner will understand the local area and have keen insight into the good and bad areas. They can also check out properties, meet contractors, show vacant units, do property maintenance, and keep tabs on them over the years. Partners, of course, bring challenges of their own. In a partnership, each party has their own agenda, personality, and way of doing business. A partner, especially when located far away from you, must be completely trustworthy, and trust can be tough to build. However, if you can overcome these challenges, a long-distance partnership can help you get a foothold in a location you don't know very well. Now, to give you some additional insight into the strategy of using a partner to invest at a distance, I want to introduce you to a friend of mine, Mehran Kamari, who uses a partner to invest at a distance because he lives in an expensive area. So Mehran, where do you currently live? I currently live in sunny Southern California, Woodland Hills, California. Well, why don't you invest in your own area? My current real estate goal is to replace my W-2 income with stable cash flow. I feel without getting creative, it's difficult to achieve that goal in my local market. Everything is so expensive and the price-rent ratios are just not great at all. I also don't like the landlord-tenant laws here. California is a lot more tenant-friendly than many other states. Well, where do you invest then? Right now, I invest in the Midwest, with an emphasis on Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And how did you pick that area to invest in? Well, it's important to decide on your investing goals so you can pick a market that aligns with them. Looking for stable cash flow, I naturally gravitated towards the Midwest market. There are a lot less volatile swings in property values and lower barriers to entry. In contrast to the SoCal markets, the price-rent ratios in some of those Midwest markets are amazing. I felt in these parts, my limited funds could go further than in Southern California. My main market now, Milwaukee, is pretty landlord-friendly too. Mehran, what are some of the challenges you faced? Well, to be honest, I've avoided a lot of the common challenges investors face by spending a lot of time on the BiggerPockets forums and learning from the mistakes and challenges of others. One challenge I've had, though, is with a bad property manager on my first deal, and that one was in Indianapolis. I made the purchase without first developing relationships with a team on the ground. I relied solely on the property manager that was already managing the property for the previous owner. Things started out smooth, but she quickly turned into a PM from hell. I started getting reports and rents a month or two late, eventually ended up not receiving them at all. I procrastinated on firing her, and it has cost me thousands of dollars now. I've learned that management can make or break any deal. As an out-of-state investor, almost everything relies on your person on the ground. They are basically an extension of you. I can't stress how important it is to not tolerate poor performance from your property manager. Well, Mehran, what has worked really well for you? On my second deal, I tried a different approach. I partnered with a local investor in Milwaukee, Don Anastasi, instead of just going the basic property management route. I didn't know at the time, but this turned out to be a game changer. This strategy is great because our interests are aligned and we're both financially vested in the deals. It's a different story when you're working with someone that can focus on your projects rather than 500 other properties they're managing. I don't just feel like another number on a spreadsheet, but we're partners. I wouldn't make another out-of-state purchase without this arrangement in place. In fact, it's worked so well that I've had no reservations in making acquisitions. I now own or co-own more than 20 properties and things are going great. Okay, so that was a quick email conversation I had previously with Mehran Kamari, which I definitely thought was important to include here because his strategy is definitely something you could adapt if you find yourself in an expensive market like Mehran did. But now, let's move on and talk about a third strategy for investing at a distance, especially if you are looking to invest in smaller single-family homes, and that is turnkey investing. What is turnkey? Turnkey investing is a loosely defined investment strategy in which the investor buys, rehabs, possibly, and has a property managed through a third party, usually from a long distance away. Their goal is to make the entire real estate investment process as simple as possible. So all you need to do is turn the key. Get it? There are hundreds of turnkey providers in America and across the world, and no two companies are exactly alike. Some will buy, rehab, rent, and then sell the property to you, the investor. Others will simply help you find the property and let you do most of the heavy lifting on the rehab side if there is any rehab to do, then manage the property for you. Again, each company runs their operation a little differently, so if you decide to go with a turnkey company, it's important that you do some in-depth research on exactly what that turnkey company will and will not do. Benefits of turnkey investing. Turnkey investing has several distinct advantages over doing it all yourself. First, service at a distance. The first and most obvious benefit to turnkey investing is the ability to invest in a good real estate market without needing to live there. Being a landlord is not always easy, and trying to be one from thousands of miles away can be even tougher. Many people who live on the east or west coast of the US, as well as many who live outside the country, rely on turnkey companies, usually in the Midwest where the cash flow tends to be higher, to invest in gray markets. Market insight. A good turnkey company knows its market with far more precision than an outsider would. You might be able to do some research on a particular area and check out the school ratings, crime reports, and price ranges, but a turnkey provider will know the heart of an area. They will also know why people prefer one area over another. They'll know why this block is worse than that block. They'll know the reputations behind certain neighborhoods, properties, and businesses. They'll have an ear to the ground about societal changes that could affect the local economy. It is very difficult for an outsider to gain this perspective because it is normally reserved only for long-time locals, which a good turnkey provider should be. Professional staff. Turnkey providers, because they are property management companies, will generally either have in-house staff or work closely with vendors to make sure your property is well taken care of. They have somebody who will answer the phone, someone who will fix the running toilet, someone who can sign a lease with a new tenant. When you invest on your own, you have to either do all these roles yourself or find someone to do them in the market you might not know. A marketing machine. Many turnkey providers buy, sell, and rent dozens or even hundreds of homes per month. For this reason, they are required to consistently drive leads to all parts of their marketing machine. They might use billboards, radio ads, newspaper ads, and other avenues to direct both motivated sellers and tenants to their business. As a result, they may find better deals than you could and get tenants faster. Management experience. Let's face it, most people are not good managers. Turnkey providers, on the other hand, are usually experienced in dealing with tenants and contractors. Their experience helps them make the right decisions more often. Simplicity. Finally, although each turnkey company operates a little differently, they all have the same goal: to make the investment property easier for you. When you invest in real estate by yourself, you are forced to handle all of the moving parts yourself, which can be overwhelming, hence the point of this book. A turnkey company attempts to simplify the process so that, ideally, you will only need to write and receive checks. The downside of turnkey investing. At this point, you are probably thinking to yourself, wow, turnkey sounds pretty ideal. Why wouldn't everyone do this? Well, there are some potential downsides to turnkey investing that you should know before you jump into that kind of investing. So let me walk you through the three big ones. Number one, financial. A turnkey company is a business that needs to make money, and they do this through several methods. First, turnkey companies often buy properties at a discount and then sell to you, the out-of-state owner, for a higher amount, essentially flipping the property to you for a decent profit. Then, the turnkey provider usually makes a monthly income by managing the property for you. It makes sense that you would pay a premium for the ease of service you get. You can't usually have your cake and eat it too. That said, remember that turnkey companies do have a marketing machine running 24/7, and as such, are generally able to find incredible deals in their market. So even if they do make a profit when they sell it to you, you might still be buying below average and getting a great deal. Number two, analytical. Perhaps the largest complaint I hear about turnkey companies is their inability to correctly analyze a property. They conveniently underestimate or completely ignore many important expenses like maintenance, vacancy, repairs, and capex. Perhaps the turnkey companies do this on purpose, and or maybe not. The point is that if you are going to buy a property, you need to do the math. Never outsource the analysis to a third party. Number three, ethical. Perhaps the greatest risk you take when choosing to invest in real estate through a turnkey company is the level of trust you must place in this provider. After all, you are relying on their knowledge and expertise to choose a location, choose a property, choose a tenant, and manage that tenant. That is a lot of trust you are placing in someone who gets paid whether or not the investment is good. It would be fairly easy for a turnkey provider to take advantage of out-of-state investors by encouraging them to buy bad properties in bad locations. In fact, I've heard many horror stories of investors who buy a property through a turnkey provider only to discover that it was a pig with lipstick that immediately began costing the investor a lot of money in repairs. So, should you invest in real estate at a distance through a turnkey company? Well, That is a decision only you can make after careful investigation into a particular company. There are both benefits and disadvantages, so you should weigh those against the possibility of investing in your own market. If you live in an expensive area and want to invest in lower priced properties, Turnkey can be a great alternative to being a local landlord. Just be sure to do your research and know what and who you are investing in. Investing in an expensive area, wrapping it up. So do you live in an expensive area? Do you want to continue living there? Luckily, you don't need to choose between living where you want and investing in rental properties, but it is going to require some extra legwork, as I've outlined in this chapter. Don't let the price is too high be your excuse to continue sitting on your couch every night watching Seinfeld reruns. Get out there, find some sale prices, or identify an area where they exist. Chapter 7, Types of Rental Properties. Thomas Sowell once said, "It is hard to imagine a more stupid or more dangerous way of making decisions than by putting those decisions in the hands of people who pay no price for being wrong." "Sir," I began, my voice trembling, I would like to ask your daughter out." The other end of the line went silent, just long enough to make my 18-year-old self wish I had never called. My stomach sank. I simply wanted to be a gentleman and ask her father's permission before officially asking the girl of my dreams out. Yes, it's a bit old-fashioned, but I knew, rightly so, from the depths of my soul that this would be the girl I would marry. So I might as well start the family relationship off on the right foot. Finally, her father spoke up and asked a simple question. "Well, where do you want to go?" I hadn't expected that response. I didn't want to go anywhere. I simply wanted her to be my girlfriend. But now I was getting 20 questions and my already nervous teenage mind didn't know where to go next. Ask her out was the phrase all the young people used, wasn't it? I hadn't thought any deeper than that. I stammered on for what seemed like an eternity, sounding like a complete idiot every awkward second. Finally, in a stroke of genius, I managed to spit out, "A movie. Yeah, I want to take her to a movie." "Oh yeah," he replied. "Which movie?" Uh-oh, more questions. This wasn't supposed to be so hard. I didn't have plans to go anywhere, but looking back, I see how my initial statement of, "I'd like to ask your daughter out," could be confusing. I racked my brain for the name of a movie, any movie, hoping the answer would suffice. Finally, my future father-in-law let me off the hook and laughed, thanking me for the call and telling me, "Good luck." You see, when I was 100% ready and committed to pursuing the girl of my dreams, the woman I would someday marry, I quickly realized I didn't have a plan. I didn't have specifics in mind. I knew the end result I wanted, but the details were fuzzy. Real estate investing is a lot like this. You tell me, "Hey, Brandon, I want to invest in real estate." And my response is usually the same spirit as my father-in-law's during that awkward conversation more than a decade ago. "Okay, what do you want to invest in?" It's not simply enough to want to invest in real estate. You need to have a plan for what you will invest in. Given that you are reading a book on rental properties, I think I can assume you want to invest in rental properties, but that is not enough. What kind of rental properties? Are you even sure? In this chapter, I want to give you an overview of the different types of buy and hold investment properties that exist, as well as the subsets within each type. The better you understand the different types of investments available, the better decisions you'll be able to make about what to buy. Let's start by talking about the most common, the single family house. Single family homes. Description: a single family residence, commonly abbreviated as SFR, is your typical house. One kitchen, one bathroom, a few bedrooms, and usually on its own plot of land. Ownership of a single-family home is often seen as the American dream, and as such, it is the most common type of real estate in existence. Prices for SFRs are based on what other similar homes have sold for, which means the price fluctuates wildly based on local market trends. Pros: plentiful. There are a lot of SFRs out there. Nearly every street in America has a single-family home on it, and new SFRs are being built every day. Strong exit strategy. SFRs are generally fairly easy and fast to sell, compared to many other property types. This is because of the large number of people in the world always looking to buy a home. Involve fewer bills. With an SFR, the tenant will typically pay for their own utilities, including water, sewer, garbage, and electricity. The owner is still usually responsible for insurance and property taxes, as well as repairs and mortgage. Easy to finance. SFRs are fairly easy to finance because, again, they're so commonplace. There are thousands and thousands of banks willing to lend on a single-family home if your credit and income look okay. Easier to manage. When a family rents an SFR, the property can be much more hands-off than a multifamily property. For example, your SFR tenant will typically not call and complain to you about the neighbor being noisy. They'll call the cops. In a multifamily property, however, they will call the landlord about the noise. More stable tenants. Tenants who rent SFRs tend to stay for many years and be higher quality renters than multifamily. An SFR is less transitional than an apartment and caters to people who are already settled in life with a stable job, income, etc. Better appreciation. SFR prices are based on the market, which is largely based on emotion and the U.S. economy. While this can be both a good and a bad thing, the fact is that if you can time the market correctly, you can often buy low and sell high, making significant equity and profit through that appreciation. The same principle, of course, applies to a market that is dropping. However, in a declining market, you can simply hold on to the property and wait for prices to someday go back up. Less expensive to buy. Although the cost per unit is significantly higher than for multifamily properties, overall, it is generally cheaper to buy an SFR than it is to buy a multifamily, commercial, or most other kinds of properties. This is because of both the simple cost, one house is probably cheaper than a 10-unit property, and the fact that single-family homes often require smaller down payments than larger multifamily properties would. Now that we've looked at a number of the benefits to investing in single-family homes, let's look at some of the negatives in doing so. Cons. High cost per unit. When buying an SFR, the price per unit can be exceptionally high compared with multifamily properties. For example, in my neighborhood, I can buy a nice SFR for approximately $100,000, which makes the price per unit $100,000. I can buy a duplex, though, for approximately $120,000, which makes the cost per unit roughly $60,000. Or I can buy a 10-plex for approximately $300,000, which makes the cost per unit around $30,000. As you can see, the cost per unit, at least in my area, is definitely much higher with an SFR. Slower to scale. Building wealth one house at a time can take a while because each transaction requires you to engage in the entire buying transaction for just one property, one loan, one insurance policy, one manager, desired. When buying multifamily properties, however, you might be able to acquire 2, 4, 10, 50, or even 1,000 units with one transaction. If your goal is to get to 100 units, doing so with SFRs can be tough. Involved limited loans. When trying to buy SFRs, you are often limited to the number of properties you can have financed on your personal credit report. Currently, the limit is usually 4 or 10, depending on your bank, and if they are packaging and selling their loans to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. However, you may have trouble reaching even those limits because of how quickly an SFR can raise your debt-to-income level above a bank's limit. Expensive rehabs. After a tenant vacates one of my apartment units, tenant turnover is generally fairly easy and relatively inexpensive. Mostly, this is because of the property's smaller square footage and the shorter residence of the tenant. On the other hand, when one of my house tenants vacates, the rehab costs can often reach into the thousands as the tenants have dug in more than they would have in an apartment. More competition. When you are shopping for a single-family residence, you are fighting to find a good deal in a sea of wannabe homeowners who don't care about a good deal. They don't care about cash flow or return on investment or future appreciation. They care about getting a pretty house in a pretty location with a pretty front porch. As such, the competition for SFRs can simply drive you away from most of the properties on the market. Trying to find that one deal that will provide you with the cash flow you need can feel like finding a needle in a haystack. Now, let's compare that single-family residence with multifamily residential real estate. Multifamily real estate. Multifamily properties, on the other hand, are buildings with more than one unit. A multifamily could be as small as 2 units in a duplex, or as big as thousands of units in a large apartment complex. Few people ever buy a multifamily to live in, though I do love the strategy of house hacking where an individual lives in one unit and rents the other units out. But instead, Most multifamily properties are owned by real estate investors who rent the properties out to those who can't or won't buy a single-family home of their own. Multifamily classification is generally split into two categories, small and large. Small multifamily properties are any property that contains 2, 3, or 4 units. Large multifamily properties, therefore, are those with 5 or more units. This is an important distinction because of the way these properties are valued and financed. Smaller multifamily properties are considered residential to most lenders and thus are seen as no different from a single-family residence. Large multifamily, however, is considered commercial real estate, and the rules change drastically. While the value of a residential property, single family or small multifamily, is determined by what the similar house down the street sold for, value on commercial property is determined by comparing the return on investment one would achieve with that of other commercial properties down the street. More technically, it's based on the return on investment an investor would achieve if they did not use a loan. This is known as a cap rate, and every location has a different normal cap rate to compare different properties against. Now, before we get too deep on that, let's talk about the pros and cons of investing in multifamily properties. Pros: more cash flow possibilities. If purchased right, multifamily properties have a likelihood of producing positive cash flow from day one. In addition, rents can be increased a small amount for each unit, or expenses decreased, and the ripple effect for those changes can cause huge increases in cash flow. One loan, multiple units. Trying to get a loan is a long, arduous process that nobody enjoys, but it is a necessary evil for most real estate investors. This is a huge benefit of investing in multifamily properties. There are a lot fewer loans to obtain. If you were to go out and buy 20 SFRs in the next few years, that's 20 loan applications you need to fill out, 20 financial statements you need to prepare, 20 yeses you need to hear from the underwriting department. Exhausting, isn't it? Instead, you can buy a 20-unit apartment building and get just one loan, one application, one set of financials, only one yes. One insurance policy. I hate insurance. I understand the importance of it, but the insurance world is just so cumbersome and frustrating. A good amount of my time and my wife's administrative time is spent just dealing with insurance. We have boxes and boxes of paperwork with nothing but insurance documents. And when you invest in multifamily properties, you likely only have one insurance policy on it. It's so much easier to keep track of and manage. Math over emotion. When investing in multifamily units, I am able to separate emotion from the transaction much more easily than with a single family home. Multifamily is all about the math, the numbers. Business, not hobby. Furthermore, it is much easier to treat multifamily investments as a business rather than a hobby because of the nature of the beast. Multifamily properties are designed for investors to own and management companies to run. Thus, the cost of hiring such a management company is often figured into the cost of owning the property, leading to less hands-on management by you. Income valuation. As I mentioned earlier, multifamily units with more than 5 units are not valued the same way as an SFR. If I were to sell you my single-family home, the appraiser would look at a few other single-family homes that were similar and base their appraisal on the selling price of those other homes. Commercial properties, on the other hand, are valued based on the return on investment they give their owner. After all, it's not very easy to compare a 24-unit apartment building with another 24-unit apartment building with the exact same returns, because you'll never find that exact similar property. Commercial investments are just too different from one another. Instead, we rely on the cap rate to base value on. If these 3 properties that recently sold gave the owner a 10% return on investment, then this one should also. So why is this income valuation so important? Because the value can be changed internally rather than relying on others by simply lowering your expenses or raising the income. Small changes to the income can make drastic swings to the value of the property, and a savvy investor can use this to their advantage to supercharge the wealth building process. Less competition from homeowners. When shopping for a single family home, an investor is competing against tens of thousands of others looking for a home. Most of this competition is in the form of non-investors who buy a property for way too much money because the front porch is so cute or the backyard is perfect for Fido. This can make competition much more difficult because you are playing a game with a different objective. Instead, when you buy multifamily properties, you are competing with other investors, which means there is far less competition, at least in the numbers. Okay, multifamily properties sound pretty terrific. So what's the downside? Well, let's talk about that. Cons. More expensive. First, multifamily properties typically cost much more to buy than single-family house. This can be a barrier to entry for many people trying to get started, so multifamily is often not even considered until much later in one's investing career. That said, smaller multifamily properties have some lower down payment financing options, and larger multifamily properties often include raising money from other people. More management intensive. I'll be the first to admit it, multifamily tenants cause more headaches than single-family tenants. They are generally more transitional and thus have much more drama in their lives. Tenants stay for shorter periods of time, which can add significant expenses to your bottom line. They call and complain for more petty reasons, have more difficulty paying rent on time, and tend to be harder on units because they don't always feel the place is their real home. That said, as I mentioned earlier, multifamily properties are often managed by third parties, so the owner doesn't need to be very involved in the management drama if you don't want to. More savvy competition. Although there is less competition from homeowners when investing in multifamily properties, the folks you are competing against are far more sophisticated than the average homeowner. They can spot a deal just like you can and generally have a lot more capital with which to buy those deals. More complicated. Most people can easily wrap their head around single-family investment properties, but more units in a property, and the more expensive the property is, the more complicated it becomes. Suddenly, you're dealing with 20 moving parts rather than just two or three. Fewer to choose from. Depending on where you live, there may be a lack of available multifamily properties from which to choose. While single-family homes are plentiful across the world, multifamily properties may be more sparse in your location. Government regulations. Finally, when you invest in multifamily properties and raise money from others to fund it, you enter a whole new world of government regulations that dictate what you can and cannot do while raising that money. If you do it wrong, you might end up wearing an orange jumpsuit and earning $1.38 an hour serving soup to the other white-collar inmates. So, what should you choose, single family or multifamily? I wish it were that simple, and I'm not going to be the guy that says, this is the right path or this is the only way to invest. There is never one right path, but there may be a right path for you. My goal is to help you see the pros and cons of each choice and allow you to weigh the options and make your best decision for you and your family. Furthermore, although I believe that focusing on one niche is helpful, it is possible to try to invest in either single family or multifamily and just see what comes up first. As long as you are willing to do the work and learn to run the numbers on either kind, you can pursue both and buy whatever crosses your radar first. While we are on the subject of property types, let's discuss some of the more common ones you might consider investing in. Each of the following could fall in either the single family or the multifamily category. Condos. Condos, short for condominiums, are a property ownership structure in which there are many individually owned units within one complex. A collection of condos often looks like an apartment complex, though it definitely doesn't have to. But rather than having one owner who leases out all the units, each unit is individually owned by a person who either lives in the unit or rents it out. The individual owners legally own each unit, but the exterior walls, roofs, foundations, and other common areas are usually jointly owned by the entire community and managed by the homeowners association, the HOA. The HOA collects a monthly fee and pays for repairs and upkeep to the common areas. Condos can be decent investment properties because of the minimal expenses. For example, you won't need to directly pay to fix a roof leak, paint the outside, or other such maintenance. But there are a few concerns that you should be aware of. First, some condo associations forbid using a unit for rental purposes, especially for the first year or two. Before investing, be sure to investigate the rules outlined in the condominium map, often called a condominium plan, and the covenants, conditions, restrictions, and easements, also known as the CC&Rs. Number two, the HOA fee can be hefty and cause your cash flow to dwindle. Obviously, you should know this before buying the property by doing your homework and including your fee in your analysis. Number three, as Joshua Dorkin, CEO of Bigger Pockets, often shares about his experience owning a condo, the HOA operations board can get crazy when normal people get into a position of power and can make life miserable for others just because they can. Number four, condos can charge special assessments, which are extra monthly fees tacked onto your HOA fee to pay for certain upgrades or repairs to the property that the HOA can't cover with its normal budget. These special assessments can quickly turn a positive cash flow property into a negative cash flow property, and there isn't much you can do about it. Number five, condo prices, especially in large cities, tend to swing wildly with the economy. Many investors find success with condos, but risks do exist. So if condo rentals are the path that you want to take, be sure to do your homework, plan for the worst, and hope for the best. Townhomes. Townhomes are very similar to condos in that they often involve multiple units individually owned within one complex. Townhouses, however, have much less of an apartment feel and are typically multiple stories in height, giving the townhouse the feel of a single-family detached home. Townhouses usually share a wall with one another because multiple townhouses are lined up side by side. Townhouses share most of the advantages and disadvantages of a condo in that an HOA generally governs the property and can make changes that affect your investment. REOs or foreclosures. An REO, short for real estate owned, is a property that has been foreclosed upon by a bank and is now owned by the bank. The term REO property and foreclosed property are often used interchangeably and both refer to the same concept, a bank-owned property. Although in the past, it was possible to buy an REO directly from a bank through its REO department, today, REOs are usually just listed on the MLS with other conventional homes. The homes are listed through a local real estate agent and sold to the highest or best buyer. In my experience, 90% of the deals I purchased have been REOs because they have been the best deals on the market for the past few years. REOs can be exceptionally good for investors for two reasons. First, there's usually something distressed about the property. Most REO properties have been vacant for months or even years, so problems such as bad smells, mold, and vandalism are common. For this reason, many people simply avoid these properties because they don't want to deal with the problems. This gives investors, who can hopefully see past superficial surface problems, less competition and a better chance of snagging a great deal. I'll talk more about buying fixer-uppers in a moment. And the second reason REOs can be great for investors, unlike typical home sellers, banks are not emotional creatures. They are not likely to get offended by a low offer and will look at your offer analytically, not emotionally. For this reason, banks are often willing to drop their price fast to get the property sold and off their books. Fixer-uppers. Remember that high school movie where the homely girl was transformed into a beautiful prom queen when she removed her glasses and put on some makeup? Yeah, me neither. I was watching Die Hard. The point is this. Human nature loves to see transformations. We love to see the before and the after and marvel at what it must have been like to get from A to B. Just tune into any episode on HGTV to see what I'm talking about. For this reason, people love to buy fixer-upper properties. But is this always a good idea when investing in real estate? Should you invest in a fixer-upper when getting into rental properties? Well, let's find out. What is a fixer-upper? First, let's get all on the same page as to what I'm even talking about when I use the term fixer-upper. A fixer-upper is a home that needs either minor or significant rehab before it can be used for its intended purpose. Being that this is a book on rental property investing, that intended purpose would be to rent out to tenants. The repairs a fixer-upper needs can range from light cosmetic work, such as fresh paint or new carpet, to more intensive renovations like a new roof, foundation, plumbing, or electrical work. I actually love investing in fixer-uppers. In fact, I've never purchased a property that didn't require some level of rehab to get it to a rentable condition. For me, it just made sense. On the 44th episode of the Bigger Pockets podcast, Michael Woodward tells a story about taking his kids to look at potential houses to buy. Michael mentions that when they walk into a house with an absolutely terrible odor, he turns and asks his kids, "Boys, what does that smell like?" In unison, they shout, "Money!" What this cute story represents is often the truth with fixer-uppers. There can be money in the mending, riches in the restoration, and freedom in the fixing. At the same time, fixer-uppers do carry a large degree of risk and can turn your investment into a money pit. So let's examine both the pros and cons of buying a fixer-upper. Pros. Less competition. Finding good, nice homes can be tough in a crowded market because everyone is looking for a nice house. This is especially true in the single family space when you are competing with owner occupants for properties. People don't want to buy a project, they want to buy a home that is move-in ready. The same is often true for multifamily properties. Investors don't usually want to buy a problem, they'd rather